We're continuing our series, really, and this second in the series, or third, is evangelizing and discipling our Muslim neighbors. It's part of my booklet on practical lessons on evangelism for evangelism among Muslims, and it's in your handbook. And some of it we've already covered, so I won't do it again. I'd like to re-emphasize that prayer is in no way to be seen as a tool of evangelism. So you don't preach a mini sermon when you pray for somebody. You're praying to God and communicating with him. If some helpful things come in that prayer, as I expect they would, that's by the way. Now, I have a booklet here which is called The Message of the Torah, Zabur, and the Injil. This is actually listed on page 17 of my booklet, or one of the pages that you've got in front of you, where it talks about, there's a list of 10 subjects. God is one. God has made man in his image. God has given man his laws. God judges man for disobeying his laws. God told his prophets that he would come among men. The birth and ministry of Jesus. The disciples came to believe that Jesus was the Messiah. The Jews wanted to kill Jesus because of his claims about himself. God raised Jesus from the dead. God gives his spirit to those who believe in Jesus. And all those subjects are dealt with in this booklet. You don't have to have the booklet to deal with these subjects, but there's some explanation here of it. An example is God is one, the first one. If you want the whole explanation in English, I do have a handout which is called A Selection of Scripture Passages for Muslims, which explains these 10 subjects and how to use them. The writer's idea, or the collector's idea, was to use selected passages from the Holy Bible in this way that is a kind of graduated way. So you take subjects at the beginning which are common, very common to both Muslims and Christians. God is one. And the collector from the Bible takes, say, Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one God, and quotes that, and then goes to the New Testament where Jesus says to one young man, he says, what is written, and he says, the idea that God is one. I can't remember the verse now, but it's a verse where he says, what is written, that you should love the Lord your God with all your heart, and so on. But I think it has an emphasis on oneness. Certainly in James there's an emphasis on oneness, where James says, God is one, and even the devils believe and tremble. So here in the New Testament there is the teaching that God is one, not just in the Old Testament. Jesus reinforces the teaching of the Old Testament in his conversation, I think, with the rich young ruler. And then James, in another part, reinforces the teaching of the New Testament there, as part of the New Testament. And so generally the passages are taken from the Torah and from the Zabur, that's the Psalms, and from the Injil, the New Testament. And there's generally a verse which is a prayer, and the prayer is taken from Psalms generally. So this is very useful to use. It's in Arabic, it's in English, it's published in India by the Bible Society, and it's Bible Society, I think, in Madras. It's in Urdu, and it's in French. I don't know if it's in any other languages, but quite a useful tool. So look out for it, or get more information about it if you would like to want to use it. And the controversial subjects come at the end, so you've had lots of cups of tea with your Muslim friends before you get on to the Jews wanted to kill Jesus because of his claims about himself, and God raised Jesus from the dead, and so on, till you get to that part, death and resurrection of Jesus, you've had so many cups of tea and on subjects that you basically don't disagree too much about, that it's going to be okay. You will be able to, without getting heated or annoyed or something, you'll be able to discuss these other problems which are more, or subjects which are more controversial, perhaps between the two, Muslim and Christian. Then I would like us to think a bit about I'd like to quote here this passage. The Muslim is not really anti-Christ, not against Christ. The Muslim, according to the Quran, believes that Jesus was willing to die. The Muslims, the Jews were intended to kill him, but that he didn't die. And they were basically trying to protect him from the shame of defeat. Here I've got a quotation. I am convinced that the bridging between what the Muslim understands of Christ and the reality of his person and work is not just a matter of intellectual understanding. In these days of resurgent Islam, Christians have a unique responsibility to respond not with counter moves or rival programs, but with the love which suffers and endures. Christ's temptation was to avoid the cup of suffering. He deliberately chose the way of the cross, and as his followers, so must we. Out of our weakness, God will show his strength. And in a sense, this is more, it communicates more than just intellectual argument. And I remember one of my Muslim friends who used to visit me when I was studying theology in London. She met some of the Christians, fellow students of mine, and she said the thing that impressed me about your fellow students was their spirit of self-sacrifice. Well, I hadn't really analysed it or thought of it in this way. There was a spirit of self-sacrifice. There was a spirit of following Jesus wherever, and this impressed her. Maybe that said more to her than some of the arguments that we came up with. But Muslims are not against the death of Christ just per se. They just cannot see how the way of suffering can lead to glory. They are not able to accept the cross of Christ intellectually. But if they see us taking up our crosses daily and following him, they may be able to understand the same self-giving love which led him to his cross. I'd like then to go on to the third section here, which is meaningful dialogue with Muslim students. I have spent quite a lot of my time working with students and also with lecturers, professors, but students. And here we've got many women students. More than half the student population in the Gulf oil countries, as I've mentioned, are women. The men tend to go off to do studies for doctorates elsewhere, but the women stay. And so you'll get a university like the University of Kuwait, which will have between sort of 52 to 58% of its students will be women. So what I've said probably would apply to students, whether they were men or women, but they are strategic. Students are strategic. You never know. 20 years' time, the student may be a prime minister or a minister of foreign affairs or a man or a woman prime minister. Pakistan's had a woman prime minister. Bangladesh has had a woman prime minister. Turkey's had a woman prime minister. So you may be meeting without ever knowing, because it's 20 years to go or something, the future prime minister of the Tajikistan or one of these countries where you're going to work. Anyway, we share not because of what people are or where they're what they're going to be, but because they are human beings, because they are women in some cases, and because they are human and because they are Muslim. We think of it in this way. But I'm convinced that even when students have renounced their most of their religious faith, if they are secular, and you can have a Muslim who doesn't believe in God, he or she will be still Muslim because they belong to that culture. But even when there's strong secularization, there are ways to reach a Muslim. Now, I'm going to take an example from talking to a man, because this is what happened. I was flying from London to New Delhi, and I was sitting next to I didn't know what his faith was, but he turned out to be an Indian Muslim. I knew he was Indian. I thought he might be Muslim, but I didn't know. So when we landed in Frankfurt, we hadn't talked very much until that point, but I happened to say to him, "Oh, Muhammad Iqbal," and he's the poet, philosopher for the Muslims of the subcontinent and is regarded as the kind of genius behind Pakistan. He had the concept of Pakistan. He died before the creation of Pakistan. He died in 1936. But he inspired the concept of a Muslim holy state, and others campaigned for it. But he was the sort of motivating kind of person behind it. He put it in his poetry and he put it in his lectures. He wrote poetry in Urdu and in Persian, and he lectured in English. And we have The Reconstruction of Islam, a book he wrote. That's his political statement in English, and it's his well-known book in English. But a lot of his other ideas do come in his poetry. And he's in Pakistan, he's one of the basic, his works have become basic textbooks, and everybody knows. And the Muslims of India, of whom there are over 100 million, probably about 150 million, they also are very soaked in Iqbal, even if they may personally have not much faith, or they may be secular in their approach. So at Frankfurt, Frankfurt Airport, I said, Muhammad Iqbal studied, he did his doctorate here, and this guy was willing to talk straight away, because his father was an enthusiast for Muhammad Iqbal. He was an admirer of his poetry, and he was a devout Muslim. The son was secular. And I realized fairly soon from what he was saying that he had a secular approach. And so I started talking about the poet Iqbal and how he had this concept of the Superman. And he was influenced by some of the German philosophers. So I didn't take it from the point of view of God. I took it from the point of view of man. We had all night to talk, and so we discussed right into the night. By the time we were getting to New Delhi, he was very interested in having more material. I told him about a book written by somebody who, I think it's called Who Moved the Stone, a lawyer who didn't believe and set out to disprove it, to prove that he didn't come out of the... I mean, it wasn't a resurrection and the stone was not moved sort of thing. Anyway, and how this man became convinced that Jesus did rise from the dead and the stone was rolled away. I told him that one, and he wanted to borrow that or have that book. I told him some other books, and he really was wanting to read these things. So I said, "Well, I'll get hold of copies for you and I'll send them." But the whole thing came from his being secular and his being interested in man as the center of the universe, not God, and his connection with Muhammad Iqbal, who certainly saw the ego and the sort of superman as being recharged by a sort of kind of revitalizing Islam. Muhammad Iqbal was he wasn't a theologian, but he somehow was expecting the revitalization of Islam, and I think he contributed to some of that. But my point is, you can approach a secular religious Muslim student through his own indigenous literature. And if you're going to stay a long time in Turkey, or even not long, or in some other part of Africa, or in Pakistan, or any of these Muslim countries, read their poetry. If you can probably get translations. Read it in the original if you can. Read it in translation anyway. Get them to recite some of their poetry and explain it for you. They'll enjoy doing that for you. Get a bit soaked in their literature, and it will give you keys. Keys of understanding, keys for communication. So I have sort of laid out here. Iqbal said, "Even in the sword-sharp cold wind of London, I never gave up my respected custom of early morning devotions." Okay, well, if you could quote that, you might be able to talk about early morning devotions. And that's in line with both, well, certainly with the real practices of Islam, the first prayer. Iqbal wrote in one poem, "Your cure lies in the fiery but sad poetry of Rumi. Your disease is that you suffer from the magic of the Western thought which has succeeded in dominating your thinking." And I collect Sufi poetry because it's got lots of references to Christ in it. And I sometimes quote a reference to Christ in the poetry of the Sufi saints and the Sufi poets. And I recall here of a conversation I had at Baghdad Airport. I spent 8 hours there once, and I was with a Pakistani student. I mean, there were three of us, and an Iraqi actress, actually. And the three of us, it's quite an unusual mix, but we had a very pleasant 8 hours. And we were all caught in this waiting for a plane business. And this student, Pakistani student, only had one piece of luggage. It was a lovely piece of wood on which was inscribed, was painted a verse from the Quran. And he showed me and this actress this treasure. He was carrying it wrapped. And I had been reading, so I showed him what I was reading, A History of Christians in Iran. And I could show him the quotation from Rumi about Christ. And the actress was secular, but Rumi was a point of contact with both of them. They both had great respect from this mystic poet. So we somehow or other started to interact, and it was quite exciting. Plays. I read Egyptian plays. Some of these are published by Heinemann. Heinemann is a publisher that publishes in English quite a lot of poetry and plays from different, certainly African and Asian countries. And I've got collections of Heinemann's, like, modern Arabic short stories. I like short stories. Sometimes they have books of poetry and sometimes plays. So this gives quite often a key in talking with people in these interesting journeys that one can take sometimes as people who go into all the world with the gospel. Another way is the use of proverbs. But not just with students, but I, as I said, collect proverbs. A Punjabi Urdu proverb is, "If it's expensive, you weep once. If it's cheap, you weep many times." Well, the cost of discipleship is high, and the cost of accepting Christ as Lord and Saviour is high. But if it's cheap, you weep many times. But if it's expensive, it's the pearl of great price, if you like. It's expensive, it's costly, but you weep once. And they understand these things, particularly students, of course. And other proverbs, there's proverbs about sowing and reaping. They come in several languages. I used to make notes of proverbs and verses that related, not biblical proverbs, but proverbs in the particular language and the verses from the Bible which connect up. And you could start doing the same. If you start long enough, you know, when you're younger, by the time you get to my age, you'll have a good collection. The point is not making a collection. The point is being ready to use proverbs to illustrate biblical truth and to lay us side by side. Lovely proverbs, interesting proverbs. There's one about the man, having caught 600 mice, the cat went to Mecca. Okay, well, I don't generally quote that straight out to a Muslim, but once in a while, with one I knew well, I might. It means having had a good time and being a playboy for a long time, having caught 600 mice, the cat goes to Mecca, you know, to put it all right. And there's another nice one. The Quran under his, I don't know, his arm, I think. Or the Quran under his arm and his eye on the buffalo. It's the eye not on his buffalo, but on the neighbour's buffalo. So, well, some of them you couldn't use that directly, but you can find ways and means of using these ideas. And, well, I like the one about the cat and the mice, but I could tell you others that I like too.